Folks, out there far and near, gather on in here. You're in for a very special treat. I'm going to introduce you first to our friend who helped make all this possible. He's a wonderful man and a wonderful drummer on Rodney's album. His name is Ken Lingard. And Ken, we're going to give the mic to you, my friend.
I'm a short Indian. I don't have my platform moccasins on. How y'all doing this afternoon? Okay. Who really knows their Hartford history here? I want to see some hands. Who's really, really, really would consider themselves? They know their stuff on the Hartford. All right, you. You in the back. Yes, sir. Well, for those of you, I'm sure a lot of you know, Rodney Dillard and his brother Douglas and the Dillards were really instrumental in the early days of Mr. Hartford's musical journey. It's been documented in several books and everywhere else, and Rolling Stone and all that stuff. But I'd like to really introduce you to the man who is still influencing bluegrass, Americana, and just damn good American music. Mr. Rodney Dillard.
Thank you, Jim.
And his wife, who's equally well-known, clawhammer banjo artist, Beverly Cotton Dillard from North Carolina right here.
Thank you, Ken. I think, yeah, this is on, yeah. Wow, Ken, that's great. Thank you very
Thanks,
much.
Thanks, Ken. Actually, I'm here as his censor.
You know, I was coming up here, and I was reading Wikipedia and all these things that's been written about John. And I just realized we're all victims of one of, you know, we are victims of the imagination of all these wannabe Hemingways, the collective imagination of all the wannabe Hemingways who write stories. So anybody that writes, it's always, even though you read it, doesn't necessarily make it true. There's stuff left out. And it's like the whisper game. Did you ever play the whisper game? When you were a kid, you'd tell something, and by the time it got to the room, it was a totally different story. Well, there's things about John that I won't talk about, which are probably more interesting than what I'm going to talk about. But John, at the end of his days, was like a logo of himself. He became a logo, which is what he wanted to do. He was very smart in how he approached everything he did. I can remember when we were kids, and he could also drive you crazy because he had such a passion for music. I remember one particular time, not when we were kids, we were all driving. Well, they were 5 years older, my brother and Doug and John. And we'd be going somewhere to play a square dance or something. And John, I remember one time he drove me absolutely nuts. This is the days when we have crank windows on the car. He tied a banjo string to the crank and to the hook on the, for the close hook up there. And he got his fingers picks out, and he played. All the first 10 minutes, it was kind of cute, but he would adjust the tuning by moving the crank on the windshield on the car, and that went on. But after about an hour and a half, I was ready to get out and run. But that was John. He would do things like that. He carried a peanut butter sandwich in his banjo case in case he ever got hungry. When I first met John, he was wearing a plaid shirt, rolled up the sleeves, and he had a long neck Pete Seeger banjo. Anybody know what those are? And he was in green khakis, green pants. And he had come over to the house because he'd heard about Douglas. They had met somewhere, but he spent a lot of time. My mom and dad had a place in the city. They had a place in the country where we actually. That's where we all congregated a lot in the country, and he would come out and spend the weekends. And in that time, we used to stay up all night long and play. And John was really into the Steamboat. He got a job. Of course, everybody knows that one. But I want to talk about maybe stuff that you don't know. I probably won't get this in chronological order. But I remember John was telling me, we first started out, it was Doug, John, and myself, and three other guys, and we had a band called the Dixie Ramblers. You know, everybody was either a rambler or a mountain boy or something. And we decided to be the Dixie Ramblers, and we had this band that we played, and I was, I don't know, maybe in 16, I think I just got my driver's license. And we had that for a while, and then John, there was a whole group of people in that area. In those days, you couldn't find another banjo player. You had to drive 500 miles to find a banjo player. Now I have to drive 500 miles to get away from one. Just kidding, dear. But we would all gather here. And there was guys, I don't know if you ever heard of Norman Ford that became the Ozark Mountain Trio. Poor Norman. I don't know if he's still alive. But he had two wives, one on the south side of St. Louis and one on the east side of St. Louis. And it was Norman and Don Brown and John. Well, Doug and I, what we did, Doug and I started just playing together with another fellow out of Kansas, Dean Webb. And he would come down, played mandolin. And we formed our own little thing and started cutting records. Well, John formed the Ozark Mountain Trio. So there's where we kind of went, not our separate ways, but we each had bands. So when we decided to go to Los Angeles, we just picked up and left. We didn't have any money, and you've probably heard that story before, but we left with $9.50 in a one-wheel trailer and left Missouri. And we weren't used to large sums of money like that, and we went through it in about 2 months. But we got out there to L.A., and this is about John, but this comes back around. We got on the Andy Griffith Show, however we did, and John was sitting in a hotel room in the Boot Heel somewhere. He'd become a record promoter. How you take back in those days, you would take records to radio stations and say, play this. And he turned on the television set and saw us there and went, crap, I can do that. Here I am promoting records. So he ended up moving to Nashville, and the rest is history for him. And that just that inspired him like young people will do it in a competitive sort of way. But if they can do that, I can do that. And, of course, then John's story went on from there and how he got started. You know, his name wasn't Hartford. You know that. How many don't know that? You didn't know that. Mm-hmm. Well, those who do know that, tell them what it was original. Go ahead. That's right. It was Hartford. Chet trained it. That's right. Yeah, a little improvement. But I remember when John first came to L.A., and this I'll never forget this because this is kind of the way the business works and how it can take its turns for the good or the bad. But we were out there, and it was Douglas, myself, and Glenn Campbell. And we're sitting in the middle of this big orchestra in Warner Brothers studio with a conductor up there who was conducting the rest of the orchestra behind us, right? And we were doing playing to print to a movie called, what was that movie?
Bonnie and Clyde.
And we were playing, and at that time, John's record, his particular record of Gentle on My Mind, had first came out and was getting airplay all over Los Angeles. And I thought, my gosh, he's got a hit. John has got his own hit. And we were sitting there on a break after doing some of the source music for that show, that movie. And Glenn Campbell says, you know what? That's a great song. Says, John Hartford. That's John Hartford. He says, you know what? Monday, I'm going to go in and cut that song. And that's what happened. I was there at that moment, and he turned to Douglas and said, Doug, I want you to play banjo on that. So Monday they went in and Glenn Campbell cut Gentle on My Mind, which, you know, if he hadn't cut that, John would have probably taken that himself to a number one record because he changed the direction and the paradigm of country music at that time. And pretty soon everybody else was doing that thing, you know, the lyrics, you know, and the way the lyrics and the melody worked together with the time. And so if you'll notice at that time, the music started taking that on with a lot of other people who were doing that sort of thing. And before it was... And he changed that whole thing and started moving the music in another direction. And you can credit John Hartford for that. And maybe Glenn took that further than John would have, but John didn't do bad with that. That was in the days when the record labels and streaming didn't rip off the artists, which is happening now. And the artists are starving and all this other, the mainstream thing. There's a class action lawsuit against that now, so the artists can get their money back because they're not getting, anyway. So that's just one story. And I remember when John came out to L.A., when Glenn first hired him on his show, I helped him get his apartment. It was over in, I think it was Laurel or Coldwater Canyon. And he was trying to figure out what his image was going to be. And he had bought this turquoise sort of a necklace thing. Really looked nice. He said, I'm going to wear that on the first show. And I think that would look nice. And, of course, he did. And he was trying to figure out what he was going to do on the show. He always thought about what he was doing. I'll tell this story. I've never should I tell him about the piranha and Jamie? Is Jamie here? Jamie's not here, is he? I had this red-bellied piranha that I had in a tank. When I was young, I did a lot of weird things. But I had this red-bellied piranha. And John and Betty and Jamie come over to the house one night. And Jamie was just a wild kid. I mean, he wasn't wild as my kid growing up, but he was a wild kid. And he was over there pounding on the fish tank, you know. And of course, John was busy, you know, talking or playing his fiddle or doing something. And I said, well, you know, I should be. And the next thing you know, he had his finger down in there wiggling it. And the piranha, they'll get like this. They'll get like a Malamute husky. They'll curl up a little bit and start doing this. The tail starts curling. I thought, oh, crap, he's going to take his finger off. So I said, John, you might want to get Jamie to take his finger out of the piranha tank. And John just turned around and calmly said, Jamie, get your finger out of the piranha tank, and went on playing. But those are just little things that make up the character of what. Does anybody have any questions that I might answer for you about John and what I knew then? If I can, I will answer them. Yeah. With John? Oh, yeah. Well, my dad was an old-time fiddle player, you know, from Burns, Tennessee. And he's an old-time, what we call buck dancing, clog dancing, like Buck Beverly does. And John would come over with Douglas, and I had to get up and go to work. And I had to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and go to work. And that was when I was graduating from high school and was getting ready to go to college. And I remember this, that my dad, who also had to get up early and go to work, never missed a day in his life at 40. Douglas and John, I'd go to bed, and John and Douglas and my dad would play till daylight. My dad would go wash his face, put away his fiddle, and go to work. But in that whole thing taught John how to dance. Do that. Can you do that step? It's a shuffle step.
No, he did the side step. John and I knew John a lot later. Yeah, it was just a side step that your dad did. Because his dad played the fiddle and danced at the same time.
And he did that lick. Well, he learned that from my dad. You know, he did learn a lot of other steps because he kept rhythm with that.
Which your dad would be playing the harmonica and the fiddle and doing that at the same time.
Yeah.
That's how he'd wake us up in the mornings.
Yeah.
He'd stand at the door and do that. But, yeah, he did a bunch of the steps like that from Pop. But, I mean, Pop was great. He'd do double back steps and everything like that when he was playing. But it was really great to see John and Pop play together and play and dance together.
I don't know if you ever, maybe you've seen this. AT&T put together a documentary of my dad's called Precious Memories. And if you ever, it's in the public libraries in Missouri and in the school libraries, but it was VHS then. We haven't re-released it or anything, but it's got John and my dad. And what really gets me about that, they do this last thing in an empty church. It's an hour long. Dad and John are in this beautiful old country empty church in the hardwood floors, and they were both doing this. And then my dad, he says, well, that's it. And they both put away their fiddles. And that was just sort of like the culmination of everything. Every time I can't watch it anymore just because
of that.
What
he didn't know was that he only had a couple of months to
my dad,
live. We wanted him to enjoy
what he had.
What he had at that moment making that video.
Yeah, and he passed away so young. He was only 90.
Yeah. But even at Burns, we were over at the hotel. They had a parade, and his dad got to be the grand marshal. Well, John's out there on the sidewalk, and we're all out there playing and singing and dancing on the sidewalk in front of the rooms. I thought they were going to kick us out, but we've been kicked out of better places.
Yeah. But that's all on the video with John, and Jamie is in that too, I think.
Yes, Jamie was there.
Jamie and my brother Doug.
And Ginger Boatwright. No, Ginger wasn't in that one.
No. I remember one time John and I were doing, a bunch of us in L.A. were doing a movie score, And this guy, anybody remember a guy by the name of Vaughn Meter? Years ago, had the White House. Well, it was Vaughn Meter's production, right? And Vaughn was in there. Of course, we didn't have a screen. We weren't working to print. We were just working to what he described the scenes. So here's all these double scale L.A. musicians, John Harford, myself, and Doug. And he's going, well, now the guy's walking down the road. Now play the music to where you'd be walking down the road. Everybody just looks at each other, and John kicks something off, and there we are walking down the road. And I remember John and I sitting, we were in this little hall where they'd put us to get isolate us because they had, they was doing live, and they had, I forgot who was on Steel, Buddy Emmons. And all this, and we were doing this thing live, so they put John and I so we wouldn't leak through, right, the guitar and the fiddle. And we started talking, and we would talk about things that seemed pretty strange. We were writing, and I said, you know, you just can't run away from your feet. And we end up writing a song in this little hall while he was describing the movie when we were supposed to be listening. We wrote a song called You Can't Run Away From Your Feet. And I don't think he ever recorded it, neither did I, but he sent me the sheet music on it, and he wrote, notated and wrote it all out.
Yeah, I still got that.
Somewhere I got that, yeah. Yeah. But the thing about John, now John was raised, I'm just curious, what do you know about where John was raised and how he was raised? Anybody know that? Do you know? Yeah. He was raised in a gated community where they all dressed for dinner. And John fought that so much, he rebelled against that, that he would come over to our house, you know, and because he'd always eat dinner with us. On the farm. Okay. And at the time, John, being a teenager, always thought he was doing the correct thing, so he'd scoot back from the table and belch real loud. Like, boy, that was good. Like, he thought that was what you do, you know. Sort of like going up to the Eskimos and not rubbing noses or whatever. And my mom and dad just kind of look at each other, and, you know, okay, John. And but John finally got into that whole thing, and when he got with Norman Ford, he sort of got out of that culture that he was raised in and got more into the salt of the earth, people who enjoy things like you're enjoying today, the music. And it was all about the music to John, believe me, all about the music. He didn't, you know, I don't know, you probably know a lot too, but it was all about the music to him. Yeah.
What was that your mother told him one time? He said, what'd you think of my banjo playing?
No, I wasn't going to tell that.
Oh, well, because no. He was so good on fiddle, but he played with Douglas. He wanted to
play that fast bluegrass stuff. But he instead, like, you know, a good creative guy, you don't want to just, you know, follow the elephant in front of you, you know, holding on to his tail. John created his own style.
Yes.
And, of course, that speaks for itself. Yeah, the pull-offs and the, and he had developed that real fast style, which was all pull-off, because he couldn't play that real fast stuff. And there was always a little competitiveness about the banjos with Doug and he. Because when we go to a place to play with all of the old guys from Arkansas who would come up, they'd say, Douglas, get out your banjo. John, get out
your fiddle. Yeah.
So John really became proficient on that fiddle. John did a lot of other recordings. He played on several things. There was an album. It's probably, I don't know if it's still in print, but if you ever want to get something out that's neat, I did an album called Woody Guthrie and Friends, and I tried to pull in as many people as I could. I had John, Hoyt Axton, Seals and Crofts, Peter, Paul, and Mary. I brought all of these people in to play on this Woody Guthrie and sing Woody Guthrie. Arlo came in and did. And John came in, and he played the fiddle on that album. So if you want to hear John in another genre, that. Or on one of our albums, I ran him through a Leslie, you know, like the B3 organ. I ran his fiddle through that. And he's playing, you know, he was playing through things. But John would always try anything once to see. He was always adventurous when it came to music. He wasn't just locked in. He would try. We'd cut an album. We did two albums together. We did Glittergrass. We cut in Nashville, and the other one called Permanent Wave.
What was Dillard Hart for Dillard?
That was called Glittergrass and something. That was the other name that they had on Dillard Hart for Dillard. We did that in Nashville. But this one we did in Hollywood, and he came in to the session, and he had borrowed this thing that it was a machine. It was like a bag. They called it the bag. with a hose that ran into the side of your mouth like this, and you would talk, and it would... And Sly Stone was the one who made that popular. So John says, I want to cut a Sly Stone song. And we all said, okay, what is it going to be? And I can't even remember the song now, but he played his fiddle, and he used this, and he talked with his fiddle as he played it. You know, he was... He experimented, you know, with a lot of things. Later on, he just pretty much stuck to the one he did the fiddle band and the stuff. And the, anybody else have any questions? Yeah. I know the song you're talking about. You're talking about Two Hits and a Joint Turned Brown? Yeah, I've really regretted that to this day. Because my line was, that I came up with, smoke a lot, get the munchies, and grow a big ass. Two hits in the joint.
That's a nice line, honey.
Screws up my memory and gives me gas. Two hits in the joint, turn brown.
He definitely wasn't married to me at that point.
Very true. That was another time. That was another reality. But yeah, that was the song. That's the one we did in Nashville.
You got a question?
We had so much fun doing that album, and it was just, I don't know, it's always fun to be. We did other, we, oh, my goodness. We had, Doug and I, our folks got us a Voice of Music Sound on Sound tape recorder. They just bought it because my dad was into music and things. And Doug and I and John made hundreds of tapes with my dad and John and Douglas, just doing all kinds of crazy kid stuff that's on those tapes. And I thought maybe one day, maybe we ought to give them to somebody and let them go through and see what they're on there that they would want to. Who? No. Yeah, there's things on there probably that John and Douglas wouldn't want played. Yeah, they did that? Huh. Well, we have all these tapes in there, and it's good quality, but, you know, for that day, because our first two singles that Doug and I cut with Banjo Nahala was cut on a Voice of Music tape recorder. So, yes, sir. No, it's just a dog that everybody had. In Missouri, you just had a dog. I tell that story about dogs. Yeah. And like I say, we were very surprised when we heard Joan Baez sing Oh Blue that time up in Newport. I got to tell you, she's singing, you know. And it's so funny how people can perceive a culture and then try to represent it, and it's like a 180. I mean, she was going, I had an old dog, and his name was Blue. Sorry, dogs.
Look at the dog turned around and looked.
Yeah, they did, see? Maybe that's what she was doing. She was communicating with all the Irish setters. And, of course, you know, we didn't feel that way about dogs where we came from. You know, we grew up, I thought a dog was my brother until I was 7. But that's another story about the chili supper and all of that stuff. But that song that I wrote about dogs, I was riding with somebody down to do a date, and we were talking about demonstrating how do you write a song. And I said, I don't know, you just let it go. And then I started singing, I'll write a song about a dog. Fall guy, pie foot, red bone dragon on cool fall nights, you can still hear his song. And I just wrote the song as we were driving like that. It was just bleh, bleh. But I couldn't do that with all the songs. I usually sat there with a number 2 lead pencil and a Big Chief tablet going.
It does still work sometime. We were on our way to a Mayberry Christmas show and said, you know, we ought to have a song called Mayberry Christmas. So by the time we got there, we had a song called Mayberry Christmas.
We fought all the way over Black Mountain.
All the way. We fought our way through it. Yeah,
but... John and Doug, back then, John, when I was with Keith Case, and John was with Keith Case and Associates, we did a lot of dates together. And there was a lot of stuff that happened on the road. when he was getting all the death threats. That was funny. Oh, yeah.
Death threats?
Yeah, I knew that'd get your attention. And I'm not going to tell you. But, yeah. And when we used to play these places in East St. Louis, Doug and I and John, they used to sneak me in because I was always underage. And I remember one place called May and Ray's. And it was those places about 11 or 12 o'clock, you started looking around getting ready to duck because something was going to happen. And sure enough, something happened, and Doug got in this brawl with this guy who was trying to poke him in the eye with a broom because it was a broom dance. And next thing you know, this whole brawl started, and John just kind of stepped back. So, well, I didn't want to get my banjo in a fight. So he just stepped back and let it. Well, there was all kinds of stuff like that went on when we played these old bars. But when you're a kid, you'll play anywhere just to play. Square dance, bars, anywhere you can, because that was the passion and the magic of playing back then. Yes, sir. I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Oh, living in St. Louis? I did not live there. I lived on the farm. And Douglas lived on the farm. But after Douglas graduated from high school, he went to college at Washington University. And my dad had a job that he'd had since the Depression. He was never without a job. We didn't know what going hungry was because we always had something. And so my dad worked up there, and we would go up there and spend the summers, or like I said, when Doug went to Washington U, and then I went to Southern Illinois University, I stayed up there. But my home and Doug's home was in Missouri, Salem. I'm sorry?
Were you doing the music with John?
Yes, yeah. Well, John, they would come on weekends. You know, it was a weekend thing, and I would drive up from the city. From the Salem, I was 16, and I'd drive this old pink convertible I had from 54 Plymouth that had Bluegrass Special on the side. I had painted on there. I thought that was cool. And I would drive up there, and Doug and I and John would pick. Let's just pick and pick and pick and pick. That's what we did, pick and pick. Yes. How did he die? Well, I remember this. We were playing a place in Boston, and we were going to meet up in Chicago the next week. And he walked up and was looking in the mirror. I'll never forget this. And he was doing this. I said, "What are you doing, John?" He says, I got this lump right here." And I says, "Well, it's where you're putting the fiddle," because I knew Byron Burnline, those guys had that, you know. He said, "It might be. I'm going to go get it checked out." I say, "Okay, I'll see you in Chicago." I never saw him in Chicago after that. In fact, I didn't see him until a little while after that. He developed lymphoma. And it was a shock to everybody. And but, you know, for 25 years, over 25 years, he fought it and brought people a lot of good music. But then he passed on from a very bad disease. Did that answer your question? Yes. My mom and dad sing and play together? Oh, yeah. 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 I grew up with the music just being, I thought everybody did it because there it was. And the way my mother was, she was really, really smart about that. She'd put her guitar behind the couch, right? She says, "Now I'm going to the grocery store. Don't you touch that guitar." That's how she worked it, and they were very happy, and they loved John, and my dad every time John they'd always play, they'd play fiddles till. In fact, John cut one of my dad's tunes on the Dillard family reunion. It's called "Hi Dad in the Morning." Huh? Really? Yeah.
Did he?
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, my dad played that old timey fiddle where you cut time. And you don't play one and then you know to stay on it. You actually cut majors and bars, and it some people who just really musically educated had a real problem with that, you know. But I had to learn not to cut time when I got to L.A. and started doing sessions and stuff. What? Oh, yeah, okay.
I had to learn not to cut time when I stopped doing a solo act, because I learned from a fiddle player just like your dad, Tommy Gerald, and he cut time.
Yeah, Tommy Gerald. She learned to play banjo from Tommy Gerald. So
when I started playing with the group, I was like, oh, what do you mean I can't just do this and do an extra one of these?
But her and John, I know they were... You guys dance a lot in some of those Canadian festivals.
Oh, yeah, we do the Canadian festivals and a lot of the things out east. And when we meet at a festival, this was before I even knew Rodney, but I knew John because I played banjo and because I danced. And he was a musician that danced a little bit. And I was a dancer, a clogger primarily, that played a little bit. So I had a step a tune that I could fold up and take with me and put a mic on. And, of course, he had his board that he mic'd a different way. We'd put them on stage together, and we'd do numbers together. So we kind of filled in the gaps because I was dancing all over the place, and he was fiddling all over the place and keeping the beat. And my three-chord wonderness just fit right in there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what created a whole other kind of music.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was fun.
Of course, we all know that the first rap music was square dance music, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Cadence, yeah. Sure was. But, I got a neat story. I'm killing myself here. In 17, was it, no, not 17, was it in 1976?
You are that old, but I wouldn't have told it.
And a man's not complete until he's married.
Amen.
Then he's finished. Was it Stompin' 76, right?
Stompin' 76.
Yeah, yes. That's where I met you. John Prine introduced me to you, but you
but I thought you were Douglas.
Yeah. Lucky you. And anyway, we're playing this place, and we flew in on this helicopter at Stompin' 76, flew over this mountain, and there was over 200,000 people at this festival. That's right. Were you there? Do you remember that? It was total anarchy and chaos, and it was like what would happen if they pulled the plug on America, huh?
I drove in early and had to leave my car there and get somebody to bring it home later.
Well, here we were at this festival. John and I were sharing this dressing room, and I'm just going to tell this. I don't care.
Oh, Lord.
We went in, first of all, to collect our money. This Keith Casey agent, and I'll never forget this. I'm sitting at the table, John's sitting here. The guy who was the security guard for the whole thing was sitting there, supposedly. By the way, he had ripped off everybody's the money.
Yeah,
and he was sitting there. Keith was sitting on the floor down there. Huh? Not till afterwards, okay? Did John ever tell you this story? So John's sitting here, and I was a little bit different in temperament than I am now. And we were sitting there, and I said, okay, pay up. We want to get paid for this. I said, well, we blah, 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 blah. He started giving me all the stuff. I said, give us our money now. And he just pulled out a .38 pistol and laid it on the table. Just laid it there. And John was kicking me under the table. Shut up. Shut up. Let's just get out of here. Shut up. Anyway, he's sitting there, and he lays it on the table, and he lays his .38 on the table, and I said, I got one similar to that. And he said, very cleverly, yeah, but it's not pointing at me. And then John really started kicking me. So anyway, we got out of there, and we couldn't get out of there. John decides to take this big 30-some-foot motorhome and drive us out, right? So here's John, probably wasn't the best driver in the world, but he started backing this motorhome out because it was running. Here we are in the dressing room taking it with all the ones were lined up, right? So he starts driving out. And as he's doing this, and I think it was this festival, not the Menominee Festival. I get that part confused, huh? Mole Lake. One of these festivals where the motorcycle gangs had taken over.
That wasn't Stompin'. They didn't take over Stompin'. They took over Stumptown.
No, it's still the one because he was driving the motorhome to get us out of there. And that's right. It was a but the motorcycle gang's motor. And as he was driving it out, he hits a motorcycle. And then all the other motorcycles go just like in the movies. So, John, we got to get out. And people were hanging on this thing to try to get out. We had people on there. It was a sea of humanity hanging on like rats on a sinking ship. And we were trying to get out of there. And John drives his motorhome through all that blocked traffic. We found ways out of there going through fields. And John actually drove that motorhome. That was the bravest thing I've ever seen him do. And he drove the motorhome out of there. Because the helicopter pilots wouldn't take us out because the fog had come in. And he was an armed pilot and says, no, I'm not messing with that. These guys are on your own. So we had to get out of there. So that's... I don't know if that's a boring story or what, but it's a characteristic to John, you know, what he was all
about. Well, he was better than the guys we were with because we couldn't get out. I walked out with Prine and them walking over cars, over the hoods, back down, yeah. all the way out, just over... walking over cars, and then a wood truck picked us up, and we rode in the back with the cut wood.
Well, that was in a danger when festivals like this were dangerous. They really were.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of bad things happen at those. A friend of ours got kidnapped at one of those things, and they put him in the trunk of the car and drove him around.
Yeah, the Pagans did.
Pagans out of D.C. They brought him.
And they brought him back, though, because he talked too much.
And I remember one time that John and I were working Harper's Ferry, a nice family festival. And they said, well, we're a little bit concerned about you guys coming in there because you draw the motorcycle crowd, and we're afraid of that. So that whole thing had gotten – we had. I mean, you know, it was a time when everybody – if you went on at 11 o'clock, you played till 2, you know, in the morning. And it was in Jam City at those times. But a lot of great memories during that time. Yeah. I didn't. She did. I don't know. I knew John, but I didn't know he wasn't a friend or anything.
I don't either. I knew, probably knew Hartford after John Prine. Different festivals.
I remember the other thing I remember.
I think Hartford just did his thing.
When John came to see us, we were in Branson.
Yeah.
And I felt like at that time, it was just a little while after that he passed, that he was making his rounds, you know. He came up and spent the afternoon with us. And at the time, I was working with Jim Stafford up there at the Jim Stafford Theater. And we went over and saw his show and everything. But I thought at that time, I said, barely, John's saying goodbye.
He and Marie both came, and they visited Stafford and us, and it was kind of the goodbye tour.
Yeah. Very strange.
Got lots of nice pictures.
But that afternoon he spent telling me about a story about two outlaws up in the mountains of Virginia. And this story, John had a way of telling things that went on for a while. I remember one time, it's funny, he had written this song. He said, I want to sing this song. I went, okay, I got time. And he was singing about steamboat stuck in a cornfield. Well, that song, I guess maybe he edited it down since after he cut it, but he was singing that song, telling the story, singing the song, and about an hour later, he was still singing the song, and after he quit, I said, John, do you think I ought to edit that a little bit? Because the song just, it was very interesting where they had the band come out and play. It was a big event. It got, because the water went down, and it got stuck in the cornfield. No. There's a book. No, I'll wait for the movie. But that was John. John was one of those guys that, and I wish I could do that. I admired him for that. Would write down everything he said. He would carry 3x5 cards.
In his pocket.
Yeah. And he would write down everything he said, you know. And I never felt that anything I said was that important.
Me neither.
Enough to have to write. Ken, can you do something? But he did. He did. And there's stuff, his ideas and things. We both get talking about religion and filtering system, and each person is a filtering system of the actual random, anyway, we would go on and on and on and have fun. And we did talk about the fact that limitations, and we came up with this, we decided that limitations breed style. And that was a conversation that John and I had. So if you know a lot about music, you really can't develop an identity. But if you less you know about music, the more concentrated it is, the more people can relate to.
I mean,
that's my story.
I mean,
you know, a kid.
Okay.
One more question. Anybody have a question? With Bill Monroe.
Johns.
Oh. I knew. No, I'll tell you. Bill was, well, I heard more, you'd hear more stories. See, Earl Scruggs and I toured together for a couple of years and cut an album together and became really good friends, but he had the stories about Monroe. They were really funny. But, no, Bill always, when he came to L.A. one time, he had Del McCurry with him and playing that time, and he said to us, how'd you boys get on that TV show? How'd you get on that Andy Griffith show? Because he was trying to find an angle there, you know. He wanted to know how he could come to Hollywood and get on one of those shows. I said, well, it was luck, circumstance, you know, timing. Wasn't anything brilliant. And I remember the last time we flew to England, Bill, he was, I wish at his age I still had that drive and that passion he had for the music and the writing. It was 3 a.m. We're flying on Ryanair, and there was about 200 of us on that plane from Nashville because we were doing the Mervyn Kahn Festival. Bill was sitting behind me, and I was so tired, and I'd start to drift off, and he'd go, Hey, Dillard, what do you think of this? And he'd sing me a line of the song. And I'd go back to state, hey, Dillard, did you know that old gal used to live down there in Secaucus, Missouri? No. Hey, Diller, do you remember the time? And he would do this all the way. And that was Bill because he loved the moment. He loved life. That's what I saw. I told that in the interview once. But he did say to me, boys, don't ever change the music. Huh, I'd already screwed that up. Yes, I did.
Well, so I got to open for Bill a couple times on a West Coast tour and ride the bus with him all the way from California all the way up through Oregon and stuff. And that was when I was first going out with him. And he kept telling me all the reasons that I'd picked the wrong Dillard. And the biggest reason was Douglas wore a nice hat.
Yeah. I'm Mr. Earl and all those guys. Well, we'll break it up here. I just want to let you know the man who introduced us here, he is a full-blood Hopi Indian. He's my manager, agent, PR guy. You ever remember a television show called Breaking Bad? He was the one who kick-started that off on the social media. That's his PR company. And I always tell this, you know, our farm that John used to visit and granted to us by Buchanan, President Buchanan, in 1865, that he had granted this, and I always say, because he had taken it away from them.
Which and he is wants it back.
Yeah, and he wants it back. But I don't know if I said anything important or anything, but I wanted to be as true to what it was and not make it a fictional story or embellished by somebody who's trying to get a job as an editor for a newspaper.
See you at 5.
Yep, we'll be on the main stage at 5 p.m. with the Dillard's 2016 lineup. We have some new songs off the brand new album that we're going to be debuting for you all this afternoon. I hope you'll be on the lookout for the new album because it's a tour de force. We brought in all the old friends. We have Don Henley and Bernie Ledden from the Eagles playing on the album with Rodney. We've got Ricky Skaggs and the Whites. Sam Bush makes an appearance on there. Yep. Yep, we got Bernie. Ronnie's going to be right here. We have the commemorative poster for the John Hartford Festival for sale. We're also going to be set up near the merch tent a little bit later. This is the last box we have left, and you want to be sure to get them signed by Rodney Dillard himself. So thank you all so much. Thank you for your attention, and enjoy the festival.